Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and more importantly, I am so fucking excited to talk to you today.
I am excited to talk to you today.
Michael, who is the other person.
Yeah.
Here with me, sort of using the power of the internet.
Right.
On this show that we call Double Feature. Now, because it is Double Feature, we're going to talk about two movies that we're going to spoil.
Yep.
I think we have a sort of a Strange Worlds episode.
Yep. We're going to include Alice in Wonderland. That's the Disney animated feature, Alice in Wonderland.
1951.
And then we're going to pair that with Don Hertzfeldt's It's Such a Beautiful Day.
The whole thing.
Right.
The three...
chapters.
Shorts. Yeah, the three. Well, I didn't want to get into chapters prematurely, but that's
I'm
an
sorry.
Excellent segue. Let
Thanks.
Me tell you, there are some chapters in our show. I'm feeling punchy today, man. There's chapters in our show. So, you know what, use them to skip over the movie you haven't seen, and that way you won't get spoiled, because there definitely are spoilers. Did I mention there's spoilers?
You did.
Well, why don't we just start with Alice, then?
Okay.
It's the Alice in Wonderland from 1951.
Right.
Based off, I believe the book is called Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, is
sure.
that right?
Yeah.
Or Adventures in Wonderland. I've already screwed this up. But I know that Alice in Wonderland, the popular title of the adaptations, is not the same as the Adventures, or maybe it's just Adventures. And
right.
I've actually read this, and I can't even remember the fucking proper title of the book.
Well, and the thing that's weird is it's such a popular property that's been done over and over and over for, I guess, what, at least 50, 60 years now?
Oh, I mean, the early ones had to be... 1900s.
Sure. And then you have something like Snow White, which there's, I mean, there have been versions of Snow White, not limited to Disney's and the one starring Michael J. Anderson.
Right.
Where I think people will generally accept that Disney's Snow White is probably the one you go to when you're thinking of the Snow White movie.
The definitive.
Yeah. Whereas Alice in Wonderland, I feel like it's based on what you saw growing up, which one you watched the most. Alice in Wonderland gets done and redone, and movies about the people who wrote it get done.
Sure.
And I feel like while Disney's Alice in Wonderland, the one we're covering, is probably the most iconic in just its imagery and the choices they make in how Alice is dressed and how she looks and the colorization and just... the general mix of bizarreness and whimsy that kind of goes along with Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that it is the definitive version of Alice in Wonderland, but what I would say is that it's never been done the way Disney does it.
Yeah, right.
I saw one. The go-to for me is the 1985 one with John Stamos.
Oh, really?
And all those bizarre, offbeat 80s actors that...
Sure.
It was an English one where Ringo Starr played the Mock Turtle, and it was a really bizarre thing.
Because I think of, you know, there's also Alice in Wonderland. There's most recently, you think, Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland.
Sure,
The 2010 one. But then there was the 99 one where like Ben Kingsley was the caterpillar and
sure.
Christopher Lloyd and Martin Short were
Isn't Tim Curry in that too?
No, I think it's Gene Wilder.
Oh, okay.
Wilder, Whoopi Goldberg, and Tina Majorino, I think, from Veronica Mars and Big Love and stuff as Alice.
And then also there's the American McGee's Violent Alice games.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
That kind of brings me back to the point I'm making, where if you look at American McGee's Alice, which is, it's actually a video game, the clothes she's wearing and the general colorization of something like the Cheshire Cat draws from Disney's Alice in Wonderland.
Right.
And granted, the book obviously has descriptors because that's what books have to do, because you have to put something in it to make it 300 pages. Otherwise, it can't be a book.
Don't these books have pictures in them?
However, Disney, I think, had managed to capitalize on the iconography that Alice in Wonderland... I don't think it has an inherent iconography. I think that the story ventures too far into the bizarre to look at it from a point of Alice will now look like this for the next 60 years.
Sure, sure.
But that's what they pulled off. That's what this film does, is it gives you a really definitive, strong point to draw from for Alice in Wonderland for the next generations.
You know, you've really got me wanting to talk about American McGee's Alice. And make sure I don't forget, we'll definitely come back to that. But let's talk Disney for a second.
Yeah, that's the other big thing.
Well, that was one of the reasons that, you know, we wanted to get this on here, is we've been searching for a while for a Disney movie to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to gloss over the Disney by any means, because right. as you say, they set up the iconography that would follow for decades.
Right.
That would really kind of become timeless. And that's something that I think, you know, if you're to credit Disney for anything beyond, you know, the current stuff, beyond
sure.
Marvel Studios and Miramax and
right.
ABC TV, you know, miniseries, and contemporary Disney's been working on a lot of stuff that's really powerful.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even want to think about that. I mean Disney as we think of them, classic animated Disney.
Right.
Last 70 years Disney. Yeah.
Right.
You know, the big hand-drawn animation years. They picked up property after property and developed, one, popularized it, brought it into the mainstream, and two, created iconography that stuck
mm-hmm.
forever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you mentioned Snow White, but I mean, you could literally read off the Disney catalog.
Sure.
And these are all things that are based on different fairy tales, based on previous stories, things that no one had heard of before, or had seldom been done prior. And I mean, Alice in Wonderland is a great example, all right? So we're looking at Alice's Adventures in Wonderland from the 19th, let's say, I think it's 1902 or 1905 or something, the silent mm-hmm. film gets done.
Right.
And then we make fucking 10, 15 versions of this damn thing before Disney hits it in 1950. And that's the one that sticks.
Right.
I mean, there is definite power there to say that.
Sure.
It's not that Lewis Carroll's book was unknown prior to this.
Right.
People knew about it. They were trying to make movies out of it. It's a classic. And then Disney comes along and finally nails it. And you see this, and I really don't know what the answer is. You see this over and over with all of these properties. I don't know if I'm yet at a point where I know how Disney has that power, or what in Disney to attribute that to. But I don't think there's any selling that short, no matter what it is.
Sure.
Even if it's just the production people who are combing through fairy tales and going, you know, what can we get the rights to?
Mm-hmm.
What, I don't know if anything Disney touches for 50 years just becomes gold because their animators are great, or they have great storytellers, or if somebody, you know, maybe all of those things are fucking terrible and there's just somebody in a room somewhere who can see the potential of every fucking sure. fairy tale they pick up.
Right.
I don't know what the answer is.
I think that Disney, especially if we're talking like the big Disney films from like, you know, Snow White up to, let's say, Lion King.
Sure.
And Lion King is late too.
Yeah.
But I think the big thing that Disney does is they have this wonderful way of blending children's films, because they're animated, right? These are cartoons. These are
right.
things that appeal to children, and that's a huge part of your market. If you're looking at target demographic, you need to start at 0 years old and make it appealing to 99-year-old people.
Right.
So I think Disney nails the demographic. It's entirely family-friendly, but with something like Alice in Wonderland, like I said, you get this dark, bizarre world, and the Lewis Carroll version isn't devoid of its weird, audacious tricks and quips sure, and violence sure. and whatever. So people are interested in seeing these tales that they've read come to life in a really vibrant and interesting way.
Mm-hmm.
And also with Alice in Wonderland, I think Disney really gets brave in its telling of the tale, because it's easy, especially now, to go see a movie that's based on something else, based on a video game or a comic or a book or whatever. And it's easy to go and see. So I'll take Iron Man 3 as an example.
Okay.
So Iron Man 3 comes out and it does this brilliant thing with the villainy in the film. It's this kind of thing where you go, wow, that's a really smart thing to do. However, that totally ruins the villainy from the comic standpoint.
Sure.
And so you get in this interesting place where you go, well, yeah, but obviously you can't have that villain in this universe because that villain in this universe would be a different type of thing. You kind of get constrained by the realities of these different films.
Right.
And the way Disney tackles Alice in Wonderland is they go, so you know that poem about the Momraths and the Toves and how there's a field of them? Disney goes, so make sure there's a field of Borogroves.
Right.
Make sure there's a field of bizarre critters in this film because, you know, there's a poem about it.
Right.
And a different film might even just take that poem and go, have somebody read it and have Alice be confused because it doesn't make sense and I don't know what the hell to do with it.
Sure.
But Disney goes, okay, so now there's this thing.
Yeah.
What does that look like? How do we make a field of them? Do they pop up out of the ground? What do they do? Disney takes this bizarre imagery that Lewis Carroll has spun off of opium highs and bizarre dementia and accusations of pedophilia and whatever. Lewis Carroll, I have plenty to say.
Sure.
But he spins this wonderful, bizarre world, this entire universe that has no basis on reality. And Disney, instead of trying to ground it in a way that would appeal to, you know, the standard 18 to 30 demographic.
Yeah.
Disney goes, okay, so now we have this bizarre world. We need to make this an animated bizarre world that appeals to everyone.
So, okay, just don't have the answer so far. Something I'm really interested in and really very much want to find out, how does Disney do it?
Yeah.
But I think the best thing we can do is just look at what's in the film that appears to be, counter to what our line of thinking, our normal line of cinematic thinking might be, and just kind of mine it for clues. Because you're talking about accessibility. I mean, I don't know. This is the other thing about that staying power, is that if you look at Disney's lineup of films, Alice in Wonderland still stays in there as one of their important properties.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are 70, 80 years later, and it's still a giant property. I think maybe kids watching it today realize it wasn't done today. But growing up, you just kind of imagine all these animated films are just pretty current.
Right.
You don't really...
Sure.
You know, you don't go, what's the newest, latest, and greatest? I mean, you do. But in my mind, Alice in Wonderland was never, you know, 40 fucking years before I was born or 30 years before I was born.
Well, yeah. And again, like, I remember watching Snow White as a kid, and I wouldn't have guessed that it came out before World War II ended.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
But I think that's part of... are you familiar with The Vault?
Tell me about The Vault.
So Disney has this thing, and it seems absolutely bizarre, but from a marketing standpoint, it apparently has turned into a brilliant tactic. It's called The Vault.
Mm-hmm.
Every 20 or 25 years or something, Disney pulls one of the films out of the vault that's been in the vault for that long. So 25 years ago, say,
mm-hmm.
Disney releases The Lion King, and it's available on DVD, you know, VHS, because it just came out.
Sure.
And then it's out and available for maybe 1 or 2 years. Then they stop production on any physical merchandise of that film.
Sure.
And they throw it in what they call the vault. And then in 25 years, it becomes the 25th edition. And then they reissue all of the films and all of the toys and all the merchandise. And they make a big promotion as if Lion King is coming out for the first time.
Sure.
Because children don't realize that you need a film in a theater for it to be a new film.
Sure, right.
If it's been off the radar for 25 years and you don't necessarily have an old copy.
Right. Well, because that's going to happen anyways.
Right.
You can either tell people they're not allowed to have it, or people can tell you they're not interested in it anymore.
Exactly.
So basically no one buys it.
Right.
Or you tell people they can't have it until you say so.
Right.
I mean, that's a pretty brilliant tactic.
And then the trick is obviously that they just release something every so-and-so years. So instead of every 25 years, you know, it's every 5 years, every 3 years, something comes out of the vault and it's a big deal. And if that's your favorite movie, you have to buy this edition because it's all different. We have the animation cells that Walt Disney himself have initially proposed as part of the special edition.
Sure, sure.
And so I think that kind of is where the staying power comes in. That's why Alice in Wonderland was new.
Sure.
Because it's coming out of the vault. It's, you know, it's come out 5 times.
We were talking about the concept of adapting something that's so fucking weird. and making it somehow accessible. That's another part of the accessibility.
Sure.
And that's one of the things that strikes me a lot about this is having read the original work and then coming to this, it seems like the sort of thing that, you know, the movie moves really fast. You just have to go with it. You dive right into it. And I think there's maybe no time for why, and that adds to part of the accessibility. Mm-hmm. This should not be accessible.
Right.
That's what I'm getting at. This should not be accessible at all. But by moving immediately into it, the pace of the book might allow some time for, wait, why the fuck is this happening? You know, you read it at your own pace. That wouldn't work for Disney. We don't want the kids thinking, why the fuck is this happening? But it's just way fucking weird. We get Tweedledee and Tweedledum. I mean, you know, I could give you a list of all of the characters, but those specifically seem kind of dark and weird. There's a lot that's dark and weird.
Sure.
It's not like today's stuff, but I also get that feeling as if just releasing it, if we hadn't adapted Alice and we were doing it now, doing it today, do you feel like this wouldn't work, or could we put out essentially the same film?
Well, I mean, we already did Mirror Mask on the show, if we're being fair.
Okay.
But I think that one of the things that Alice in Wonderland, Disney's version does, and that Alice in Wonderland as a story does, that is just an absolute faux pas in film in general and writing, is that when you get these films where somebody is suddenly immersed in a bizarre and terrifying place, Mirror Mask being a perfect example, one of the first things that happens is they encounter somebody who is benevolent and they can trust.
Sure.
And that will be on their side, and that they may know more about the world than our new character does. And so maybe they'll guide them through some of the scarier bits knowing how to deal with that world. Well, Alice in Wonderland, Alice gets brought into a world with completely untrustworthy characters. Everybody's selfish and looking out for themselves. The only characters that even acknowledge her at the beginning kind of just make fun of her and, you know, go on about their bizarre daily activities. The closest thing we get to a friend in the entire film is the Cheshire Cat, who I think is the poster child for the guy you can't trust in your new surroundings.
Gets Alice in trouble, you know, later in
and
it.
And so I think just from a writing standpoint, I can't imagine seeing a film come out where you get put into a scary place, and I mean, aside from horror, right?
Yeah.
In horror, you get thrust into these terrifying environments and there's nobody around to help you. But this isn't a horror film. This is a whimsical, musical fantasy film.
Sure.
And even in, you know, the quintessential fantasy films like Lord of the Rings, you get these people who, oh, I've never been outside of the Shire before. Good thing I came across this person who knows the entire universe.
Right, yeah. Well, and as you look at our escapism films, you look at something like Coraline, or like you said, Mirror Mask, you know, you start to think back to what roles do those characters play? Do they play on? I mean, Coraline's a really good example. Actually, that same feline sort of role of friend or foe.
Sure.
And you consider that all the time in Alice in Wonderland. Every time you come across a new character, it's, is this person here to help me or to hurt me? And you're right. I think it's not either of those. They're just self-absorbed.
Right.
They can't be bothered. They don't care.
Sure.
They're just people you're talking to, and you know, they're not really going to stop what they're doing and look out for you. So you're just hoping to mine information from them. I also think in the time it came out, it was probably even more accessible than it is today.
Sure.
Because of everything that's changed in the conventions of animation. Not just in the way it looks, but also just the types of things you do in animated films. The style that looked sort of goofy then, I don't know, I think looks frightening today.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the things that I get the feeling Alice in Wonderland is playing off for laughs, or characters that are sort of, they're mean, but they're funny mean, they just scare the fuck out of me.
Yeah.
Anybody whose eyes, you know, whose eyebrows make the mad eyebrows look.
Yep.
I'm terrified of them. And then also there's the sound in the movie. You know, the style of music that's used, which is probably one of the biggest differences that makes it noticeable as not something that just came out last week.
Right.
I mean, you can't just not talk about the style of animation. That's a big one too, but I think that's the obvious.
Sure.
The sound starts right from the beginning. We get kind of a title song. There's music throughout the film.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's those old school cartoon cues, you know, music cues that, I mean, they're taking parts that,
right.
you know, something sweeps across the screen or different elements fall into place, and they're accompanied by single notes that kind of dance along with them. Then you also have characters who are delivering dialogue, but the music has decided for you it's going to make a song mm-hmm. out of the dialogue.
Right.
Songs were just customary
sure.
in animation back then. You just expected to find stuff like that. And when you watch that today, the kind of no one's talking about it whimsy of, well, I guess there's just music and there's just songs and music cues now. It seems really strange. Also, the instrumentation. Hearing that real brass
mm-hmm.
is so much more shrill by comparison than the kind of soft, you know, synthesized music you would hear.
Right.
And if
right.
you would not hear squealy brass like that, I mean, it's in every song, you know,
sure.
it's not just when something's supposed to be frightening. Reminds me, you remember, of course, Spiral,
mm-hmm.
The unobtainable jazz score from Spiral. Joel David Moore, I'm still waiting to hear back about that. Or Adam Green, please email us. I want the fucking score from Spiral. But it would use brass in these crazy, crazy moments to just make you feel what the fuck is happening. Alice in Wonderland does not do that intentionally, but watching
right.
it today, you hear that brass and you go,
yeah.
oh my God, someone help her. This is not okay.
Yeah.
So this might be another clue about the staying power. This movie is using what is absolutely my favorite movie blueprint cheat. It's reverse engineering the sort of narrative or storytelling mechanism by going, well, here's how we're going to write our outline. Let's come up with a series of icons, and then we'll just find a way to connect them
mm-hmm.
into a string that'll become the movie. So in something as surreal as this, a narrative does not need to drive the plot. So this is a perfect method. What you have is this series of encounters. She's just coming across each character, and that's how you know where you're at in the movie. Trying to get out or trying to get home, I mean, that can be your excuse for it, I guess. But it reminds me of that Totoro style of exploration and encounter. I mean, even more so than Totoro did.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, thinking about it now, I can totally see why Disney was attracted for so long to Miyazaki and where that partnership that seemed quizzical at the time we talked about it, why it just seems totally natural now. Although Alice is probably a lot more theme-heavy than something like Totoro. It's also so many more icons. I mean, they're just every couple minutes, there's a new character with a new style. And, you know, a new, it's almost like you need a different way of talking to each character to try and get information out of them. When you finally come to things like the trial, the excuse for having the trial is mostly just because it's a memorable scene.
Right.
We decide to have a trial at the end just as quickly as we decided we were going to behead a little girl
mm-hmm.
for basically no reason at all, just so we can get to a scene where we see, you know, the queen as judge, because that's awesome.
Right.
From the time of discovering the rabbit with the watch and going down the infamous rabbit hole.
Sure. Well, following the white rabbit down the rabbit
that's
hole.
That's it,
is
right?
That's just a turn of phrase now.
Yeah. The pool of tears, the bigger and smaller.
Yep.
I think about the song from Sucker Punch.
Mm-hmm.
Encountering the caterpillar is another huge one, or the Mad Hatter, the Tea Party might be one of the biggest ones you think about from the movie, even though it's...
Yeah.
fairly brief.
Eat me, drink me, you know, other Marilyn Manson related things.
Yeah, right, right. These are the icons that really people have picked up over time. And you don't just think of one Alice in Wonderland icon. I mean, there's so many. You know, actually, as I was watching this, the song with the flowers, where they're mm-hmm. the flowers
are... Sure, Golden Afternoon.
Is that where you think maybe... I know we talked in May about referring to legs as stems.
Oh, that's...
I had never noticed that.
Yeah.
And I know that was kind of just an odd, quirky thing, but she calls her legs stems because they're talking about her as if she's a flower. Mm-hmm. I think maybe that's where that came from. Maybe that's what
Very
that's
possible.
To. And then all of this without, you know, really talking about meeting the queen or painting the flowers.
Mm-hmm.
You could really give a breakdown of every single scene. So we're just going from one of these things to another. And by coming up with a list of incredibly sure. memorable characters, you're really making a plot that maybe you wouldn't describe at first as being character driven, but it's interaction driven. It's we just want to meet and talk to the characters. That's our mm-hmm. utmost concern and nothing else we can even be bothered with. How do you get more character driven than that? Can we talk about Kafka?
Yeah.
Because if you just describe the adventure to me, I'm going to go, okay, well, we're surrounded by death at every turn and we're in a world where nothing makes sense.
Uh-huh.
We're making all these comparisons like fucking mirror masks. Should we be talking about the trial a little bit?
I mean, when you go back to someone like Lewis Carroll and where this book came from,
mm-hmm.
it's really bizarre to consider whether a theme that's akin to the trial was intentional or mistaken based on all these rampant accusations that have gone around about Lewis Carroll. Because, you know, obviously you're going to get that thing. The same as when we did Naked Lunch.
Yeah.
About how the guy who created Alice in Wonderland was so fucking high that's why the story's so fucking weird. And he doesn't even know what the hell's going on. And then sure. there's the other camp that, you know, writes him off as a pedophile who really wanted to, you know, have...
Do pedophile things?
Well, he wanted to have some sort of relationship with a young girl named Alice and... created a wonderful, whimsical world where she could be having a great time all the time.
Sure.
That's just another accusation. And where that sense of complete and utter loss of everything comes from, whether it's from the drugs or the pedophilia or just being a weird guy who writes wonderful novels, which sure. I don't think anybody ever accuses anyone of, but I think that more often than not, that's probably what's going on.
Weird guy writes a bunch of wonderful novels. These things can happen in parallel to each other as well.
Right. Well, and that's the thing is if
although we don't like to think about that as a society, that's where our brains are very not okay with that.
If you want to take something like the trial and just, you know, look at Franz Kafka, real sad guy, writes wonderful novels. It's definitely...
You think there's some parallels between the authors?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that one is just a version of another.
Sure.
One is bleaker and more adult, while the other kind of goes, even in a whimsical world, you're fucked.
Right. So that's the first thing, you know, you're surrounded by that world. That's the first theme you pick up on. And you're reminded of it really constantly. Both the whimsy of the world, but also that death is looming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by the time you get to Off With Her Head, it's a lot more obvious. But just thinking about all of these occasions of, you know, burning the house down, dying in the sure. fire, all of these terrible things that could happen in this unknown world.
And obviously it ending with a trial. We can't let that
okay,
go.
Yes, and maybe perhaps there's also a parallel there. I think another thing that's interesting about Alice in Wonderland is its focus on these little quizzical puzzles and talking about her entire life becoming just this pointless, crazy puzzle. You know, she sees puzzles just as often as she brushes against death, and rarely does solving the puzzles really fucking help her at all. So, you know, it brings in this other theme of mm-hmm. wondering about, I mean, you want to talk about grand philosophical objectives here, wondering about the pointlessness of life,
mm-hmm.
and then talking about subversion, coming in as an outsider and that's something that a lot of the other Alice in Wonderland fiction has picked up on, is Alice comes in as an outsider, tries to implement some real world change on this crazy environment run by this tyrannical queen. So there's also that sort of element to Alice, not big, I guess, in Disney's version, although a little bit of it's there.
Mm-hmm.
I think in Disney's version, she's really excited to help them paint the roses red.
Sure.
You know, you don't spend a lot of time talking about that resistance, but there's something about bending over to appease a tyrant that is particularly mm-hmm. highlighted in the 51 version. I think because that's how you make the queen this larger than life Disney kind of character. So for all the subversion that maybe doesn't appear in this rendition of Alice in Wonderland, we focus even more on, look, the queen just comes in everybody does what the queen says. You know, they don't question it. The games literally bend around her rules.
And you can't, I mean, I know that it's one of those things that people are going to roll their eyes at, so I'll make it brief, but you can't deny the question of 1951, the red dictator has all of sure. its disciples bending over at sure. every whim.
There's political ramifications to that. There's anytime you tell a story about a tyrant, I mean, that's going sure. to be a timeless. We would hope there's less tyrants as time goes on, but you know, you will always find tyrannical things in the world, and fucking bravo for, you know, I mean, I guess it lends itself well to the character Disney's trying to really hype up, but to have her come in and just focus so much on the political side of that tyranny, that, you know, Disney's also really well known for celebrating the, aristocracy, the monarchy, mm-hmm. you know, princesses are a huge part of Disney culture.
Right.
And so the only time we see royalty in this film, you know, Alice has a little bit of an aristocratic kind of lesson in the beginning, but we come across this queen who is just a fucking dictator. And so I always really liked Alice in Wonderland as the one where Disney tears down the tyrant.
Yeah.
And I think that's fucking great. Of course, as an atheist, that's going to be, you know,
sure.
tyrannical overlord making children question mm-hmm. it. I think you can connect the dots for yourself. Then finally, there's that big one of loss of innocence. That's
right. Sure.
Being thrown into this environment. You know, you're sleeping away against a tree because you're not enjoying the boring lessons of adulthood. And so then we're thrown into kind of the terrors of adulthood right away. You know, all these things she's daydreaming of become, I mean, look at the first fucking thing that happens to her. She has to fit through this conventional door that everybody has to get through if they're going to, you know, carry on in the world. And then also she's struggling to maintain a comfortable size and shape. I mean, I don't think I'm reading into this too much if I'm,
right.
you know, if we start talking about puberty, right?
No.
Young girl eating and drinking, can't quite, you know, fit into her own body, and then immediately entering into what could appear to be a meaningless race into adolescence. All right, we're just going to have to cover more Alice in Wonderland movies because there's just apparently way too much fucking stuff to talk about. But I did say I'd get back to American McGee's Alice, and rather than do that thing I always do where we just disappear into the next because the show's only 45 minutes long, mm-hmm. American McGee's Alice, I know you were baiting me with this. It uh-huh. is far and away my favorite Alice in Wonderland. It's very much a takeoff of maybe even Disney's version, but you know, any place you want to start with that. I found that originally because Chris, I think his last name is pronounced Verena, Chris Verena, who is former Nine Inch Nails or part of the Nine Inch Nails touring collective or remixes for, mm-hmm. has something to do with Trent Reznor, wrote a really great score for it. And it's a bizarre score too, because it uses pieces of the video game dialogue in it, which, mm-hmm. you know, 1990s, or I guess this was 2000, video game dialogue, perhaps not the best recorded source material ever, but to sample that and use it. So this game came out, it's set in a post Through the Looking Glass world.
Mm-hmm.
I guess an all-inclusive conversation would mention Through the Looking Glass as the follow-up to Alice in Wonderland.
Mm-hmm.
And so even after that, American McGee reimagines Alice, but as a continuation of the previous stories. So he's just imagining what happens years later. And this is at a time where even after the events of Through the Looking Glass, Alice's house burns down in a fire. She loses her whole family. She's fucking traumatized. They put her in a ward, and that's when she revisits Wonderland. But Wonderland, thinking about it as a component of her mind, is now even more twisted by this trauma she's experienced. She also feels that Wonderland is really real, and so you're playing a lot with the psychological aspect of that. So I think back in 2000, great, but what is completely unsung is in 2011, American McGee did Madness Returns, the follow-up to American McGee's Alice. And it's even darker. There's even more, you know, a lot of adult themes that are invoked. And probably of any of my takes of any of the spin-off Alice in Wonderlands of anything, I think Madness Returns for as much credit as people didn't give it, probably my favorite. Anyways, It's Such a Beautiful Day.
It is.
Also true, but the movie I wanted to talk about.
Uh-huh.
Ross Mahler, who, again, another last name I'm probably not pronouncing correctly,
mm-hmm.
was a backer of our Kickstarter. And this was the film he wanted us to take a look at. But I have to just completely hand this to you because somehow you know so much more about this director, probably from accidentally seeing the film prior to our show.
Right. So here's the thing. Don Hertzfeldt is the guy who created It's Such a Beautiful Day. Now, my exposure to Don Hertzfeldt went back to when I was a sophomore in high school.
Sure.
Are you familiar with the Rejected cartoons?
Yeah, I found out about them actually through doing research for this movie.
So the Rejected cartoons in, when was that? 2005?
Sure.
2004 when I was in high school. That was the beginning of memes.
I think Richard Dawkins would have a point of argument with you.
Sure. Well, but it was one of those things that you sought out on the internet, but there was no solid base of where to find things. There wasn't a YouTube. There wasn't a Vimeo.
A Vimeo where you can, pay $2 to watch a film?
Right.
Is that what you're alluding to? So if you haven't seen this movie yet, don't spoil yourself. Pay $2.
Yeah.
Watch it on Vimeo. Or I think you can pay $6 and just download the whole goddamn thing.
So you had to kind of, do some searching to find it and download it on your computer,
Underground animation, man.
What the Rejected cartoons were purportedly was Don Hertzfeldt had done a bunch of test spots for ads for a couple companies and whatever. And these were all cartoons that failed and were rejected as commercials.
Sure.
And they're all hilarious. Just tons of little quips and lines that your friends have been saying for years that you didn't realize are from.
You didn't know where they're from.
Rejected cartoon.
Let's name a couple of the most popular ones because I think more people have seen these than they know.
Sure. Well, there's My Spoon Is Too Big.
Thank you.
That's the big one.
Uh-huh.
My Anus Is Bleeding. That's another really popular one. I'm a Consumer Whore and How.
Yeah.
Just stuff like that.
And so these were, I think these ran, you're also going to get me chatting a lot with talk of memes, but I think these seeped into the public consciousness because of how new the internet was.
Sure.
And the internet garnering this reputation of a place you can go to find weird things.
Right.
The Rejected cartoons were the weird things that you would find.
Right.
This was the promise that the internet was delivering upon.
Right. So flash forward to now I'm living in Chicago and I find out that Don Hertzfeldt and another animator, Bill Plimpton, have announced that they're doing a traveling animation festival. Called the Animation Show that they're going to do annually, and it's coming to the Music Box. So I'm thinking, oh man, the Rejected guy, he's going to be at the Music Box. This is going to be hilarious. So I go, and very surprisingly, Don Hertzfeldt's effort into the Animation Show is It's Such a Beautiful Day.
Sure.
Now, if you've seen the Rejected cartoons with such pithy lines as "My anus is bleeding for the love of God and all that is holy," "My anus is bleeding," It's Such a Beautiful Day kind of comes out of left field.
Yeah.
It starts in a way that the first scene in this film is always the one that stuck with me, where Bill and the other guy are walking towards each other, and the one fellow says, "How's up?"
Sure.
And the ultimate closing to the conversation is, "Way."
Right.
That was all it took for me to be watching this online and go, "Oh my God, I've seen this."
Yeah.
Because I hadn't remembered that it was called It's Such a Beautiful Day. I just knew it was that Rejected guy's movie.
Right. And this is, so that's the beginning of the three chapters, which are done over a course of, 5 years or something.
Right.
And coming out every couple of years. So you really are watching a movie that basically took 5 years to do.
Mm-hmm.
Everything Will Be Okay, I'm So Proud of You, and then finally, It's Such a Beautiful Day.
Right.
So when you talk about the film, It's Such a Beautiful Day, that is the combination of the three.
Right.
And I think, it comes out of left field, but, to try and imagine the end of the third chapter versus the beginning of, coming off the Rejected cartoons.
Sure.
You can kind of see how we're dealing with those same social, oddities, awkwardness.
Right.
Just the normal It's not quite irreverent, but it's
Don Hertzfeldt in both Rejected, but also, and far more so, in Such a Beautiful Day. He has this uncanny ability to, I don't want to use the phrase prey on, but exploit this thing that we kind of talked about it when we were talking about awkwardness in comedies.
Mm-hmm.
He does this thing that in It's Such a Beautiful Day, a lot of the narrative mentions stuff that would be cast off as unimportant or irrelevant, but instead humanizes the story so much more deeply because the narrative is of stuff that often goes unsaid in day-to-day life. Something like Bill always grabs the produce from the back because sure. He's aware of people's crotches.
Yeah, I mean, the strange world here in this half is the world we live in.
Right.
You know, that's...
Well, and the kind of details that we get throughout the film are never the details that you would normally get. When we go later on and we start talking about his grandmother's life and how her uncle was feral and pooped blueberries.
Yeah.
And so he goes and dies, and then a sunflower grows out of his head. That's entirely irrelevant to the story.
Mm-hmm.
However, it puts a button on the end of that little segment of the tale.
Right.
That makes you spiral into a whole type of philosophical thing. It'd be one thing to go, and then he died.
Yeah, right.
But it's another thing to go, and then he died, and a sunflower grew out of his head, and then move on. Meanwhile, you're sitting there going, wait, what does that mean?
Yeah, right.
What is the relevance of this insane person who can only say Bible and a sunflower grew out of his head within 5 days? Does that mean that his brain was particularly fertile because it was, you know, what are you saying by that? And is that a genetic thing? Is that going to happen to Bill? Does he have sunflower seeds in his brain? Every little unnecessary detail that this film gives you scares you.
You pine over it.
Yeah. It brings you into a whole different scenario and you go, why did you tell me that? What's the relevance? What is the importance here?
Sure.
And oftentimes the relevance is there is no relevance, but this is a thing that happens. And looking at it from this perspective, watching, you know, I always think of the scene when he says he looks out the windows and sees the sparrows rebuilding their nest.
Mm-hmm.
And while they're saying that, I'm sitting there going, well, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Because they're just going to get their nest wiped away again. And he goes, he didn't know whether he was happy or sad.
Oh.
And you just go, yeah, I mean, neither do I.
It's also great that as you're watching it, you start to try and categorize these things into, is this one saying absolutely nothing? They can't all mean something.
Sure. Is this one a joke?
Yeah, right, right. And then as you get later into it and start to learn more about the deterioration of his brain, they call back to some of the weirdest, you know, hooks for arms kinds of things and go, yeah, his brain was fucking falling apart.
Sure.
And you go, oh man, those are grounded in the most reality of all.
Mm-hmm.
So you probably think you identify with Bill a little bit then? I mean, in this being our actual world?
It's one of those things where yes, and I'm terrified of it.
Sure, right.
Because by feeling like you identify with this guy who essentially comes off as an outsider to the entire world and thinks that human activity is this bizarre dance.
Yeah.
And then seeing what becomes of him terrifies you because there's never a definitive point where you go, okay, I no longer really follow this guy.
Right.
To the moment where Bill is disappearing with the stars, you never quite go, okay, this isn't me anymore.
Yeah.
Eventually, you start going, man, I wish that was me.
I came at it from the opposite way. I tried to put that off as long as I could.
Yeah.
I just went, Bill's not me. Bill's not, I see your social oddity. That's not me. And then at the point where he eats a whole fucking box of crackers and then refuses to get up.
Yeah.
I go, okay, fine.
Yeah.
Fine. I'm Bill. I give up. Where are you taking me? If you haven't actually watched It's Such a Beautiful Day, the way that this thing looks, you know, it's deceptively simplistic at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
It's a couple stick figures. It doesn't even take up the whole frame. And it's, you know, it's hand-drawn. And then it gets more complicated as time goes on. I don't even know if that's necessarily by design so much as the ability.
By necessity.
You're just working on it so long is my thought. But yeah, it does seem like it's critical to tell the story by the time you get to the end. as if how would you have done it any other way? The entire movie was created on a 35 millimeter, you know, animation stand, old school, back from the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
The Vimeo page actually claims this is one of the last few cameras of its kind left in the world that he was using to create this. So, you know, when you first start watching it, you get used to what that looks like. And I don't know if it was the same for you. After a certain amount of time, I forget I'm looking at stick figures.
Yeah.
Especially you get to the end and, you know, it's pretty heavy. It's pretty powerful. And it's really sad.
Sure.
And this is coming from, you know, hand-drawn. I don't want to say anybody could do this, but that's sort of the idea, is look what we can accomplish.
Sure.
Simply with stick figures.
Right.
How else do you think we're doing this? Let's take the animation out for a second and not go, it's just so well drawn that it evokes emotion. I mean, are you sucked into the narrative, or what's making you sob at the end of this movie?
Yeah, I think the narrative is brilliant. I think that the delivery of the lines at the beginning,
it's kind human of narration. Like, that should be stated too. This is, I mean, there is a real person in the film, even though you're only hearing their voice.
And it seems like at the beginning, he's saying things and his delivery is so dry that he's kind of making jokes and it's supposed to be hilarious the way he's delivering it. But he never changes his delivery. The delivery at the beginning is kind of, you know, tongue in cheek and a little bit sarcastic. But then as the story changes, without changing the tone of the narrative, the narrator starts sounding a little bit confused. And instead of it seeming intentionally sarcastic and ironic, it starts, the things that initially would have seemed sarcastic suddenly sound like maybe all the information isn't there.
Right.
And now I'm not making fun of it as much as I'm just trying to state what's happening because it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
Sure.
And then later, it becomes the complete other end of it, where it seems like, again, by using the simple narrative and the same tone of sarcasm and trying to be obvious, it starts to come off as, okay, I have all this information, but I need to baby you because you're not going to quite understand where this is about to go.
Sure.
What's going on in the story lets you think this part's sarcastic, this part's confused, and this part is omnipotent. And I think that by just using a very simple narrative and letting it seem human and completely aware of everything, I think that that puts you in a very deep place inside the film. That, along with the way the score works and how some of the sounds are absolutely horrifying and outside of the realm of what looks like the animation should be.
Well, we get that variety of background images.
Sure.
My favorite of which being the out of focus pig behind the glass, kind of whatever the fuck that was. But yeah, man, few opportunities you have to impact the mood in such a restricted medium. But seeing these things that are often scary or abrasive or just terrifying. And if I understand right, a lot of them had to be done by printing them out one frame at a time to work in that animation environment.
Right.
There's a great deal of sophistication in simplicity. And I've talked a lot, and I hold back when I say, you know, my interest in minimalism. I have a strict obsession with minimalism. And in film, we see that pay off again and again in something like this, where you can clearly point to the maybe four or five components that make this up. You know, hand-drawn medium, background, imagery, music, narration, you know, four things. I'm probably leaving something out. But then you get to the end and you've discounted, oh, it's hand-drawn, it's stick figures, and it's still moving you. And you know, you think about, well, how is it moving you? You're still telling a story, and there's so much purity to that kind of simplicity. You're going, well, this is just a story I'm moved by. It doesn't matter how it's being told to me. Maybe it's I don't want to, certainly don't want to discount the performance of the narration, because like you were saying, there's a lot to that.
Mm-hmm.
All of the elements are working to do the best that they have to and they can for the film. But I think our heads are doing a great degree of the work, not just in this, but anytime we watch anything, anytime anything gets to us. When we talk about don't show the monster, that's the whole concept.
Right.
Your head tailors something specific and unique for you. The exact opposite of lowest common denominator.
Right.
And so what you get is this thing that speaks to you individually, and all mediums can do this. That's what It's Such a Beautiful Day reminds us of. That is the gorgeous, amazing thing about it, that power to get to us is built right inside our own heads. Something that speaks to us with such simplicity like this just kind of reminds us of that. Anyways, we have to talk about next time on the show. We have executive producers who helped out this time, and that was Lucas Duvall, Enrique, Mike Shaw, Dust, and Eric Tachek. The website is doublefeatureshow.com, and the email is doublefeatureshow@gmail.com.
All right, next time on Double Feature, we are doing Tenebrae, and we're going to do that with The Secret Beyond the Door.
Hey, no article. I believe it is Secret Beyond the Door.
Oh,
and if I'm really going to be a stickler, I think there's an ellipsis in there somewhere as well.
Watch more fucking film.
Bye.